Hi, I'm Vince Neil of Motley Crue. We're on the road a lot in New York State, and we worry about drunk drivers just like you. We don't want to get hit. So Governor Cuomo asked me to help him keep drunk drivers off the road. They killed or injured 19,000 people in New York State last year, and 1,500 were teenagers. We don't want to lose any of our fans.
It's one of those dumb things that, you know, you go just four blocks down the street to the liquor store to get some more booze, and you come back and somebody's dead.
This one, the song's dedicated to Razzle, to our drummer who died 3 weeks ago. I hope you'll feel the same way I do about it.
Touches. Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and this is the third episode in the Motley Crue series, their third album, Theater of Pain. And for this episode, I'm finally joined again by Ryan and AD from the Shabby Road Record Show. Hey, guys.
Hey, BJ. It's a thrill to be back on your podcast again. It's been way too long.
Yeah, it has been.
I'm excited to do this one.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, the last time you guys were on must have been the Number of the Beast, right? I think that was it.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
was it? Wow.
It was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. But, you know, one of my favorite episodes of all time is Statutory Rock. So that definitely goes down in rock and or roll history.
mine too, BJ. And as a matter of fact, we put it in the Shabby Road Record Show feed. We were such fans of that show.
Yeah, that was big fun.
Yeah, it was great.
How come we get ourselves into this with you? What's the matter with us?
Yeah, I sent you guys a message and asked you if you wanted to roast Theater of Pain. So that's kind of what this episode is going to be. Spoiler alert.
I thought we were doing Theater of Pancakes.
Theater of Pancakes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I did research on the wrong album. At the buffet.
Yeah, this record came out in June of 1985. And I've always thought that if you took the ratio of quality of music to record sales, this has got to be one of the, you know, biggest gaps between the two in the history of music. This is, to me, a band that went into the studio with maybe one song and then made the rest of this shit up as they recorded it.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that statement.
I've kind of found this whole album to be so derivative of Shout at the Devil. It's like, okay, we need to have a Shout at the Devil. Okay, we need a Too Young to Fall in Love. So every song on this record seems like it's derivative of their Shout at the Devil record. Like, okay, now we have to have a song that sounds like, you know, one of these. So basically they did a bad cover, I think, of a bad album.
All right, so that's what I was going to ask you guys is, so are you guys fans of Too Fast for Love or Shout at the Devil?
Fans is a strong word. But I'll talk about my story real quick, and then I'll toss it over to AD. I grew up in this era, and I remember when Shout at the Devil came out. I was a fan of Motley Crue for sure, as all of us 11-year-olds were. And so at that impressionable age, I just thought, wow, these guys are awesome, and so couldn't wait to get Shout at the Devil, and loved the album back then, and still appreciate it now. It's got some real great songs on it still, and then my buddy Chris got Too Fast for Love like the following year when it was reissued on Elektra, I guess it was. And then right after that, I remember Theater of Pain coming out and all of us being very excited. You know, I was 12 years old and got it probably the week it came out. I remember it looking up at the notes like on Wikipedia of the release date. I was struck by, it was like June of 85. Oh yeah, okay, I remember it was summer and we weren't in school. Right. So that kind of triggered that memory of like, oh, man, we were so excited. It was summertime and all that stuff. So, yeah, I think Too Fast for Love is the coolest of all the Motley Crue albums. Shout at the Devil. The satanic imagery doesn't hold up as good, but it does have some great songs in it. So that's kind of my story there. So what do you got, AD?
I'm kind of on board with that. I think I'm on board with that. I mean, with Too Fast for Love was cool. I thought it was a pretty good record. I knew it was raw, and I knew that they really didn't have a lot of actual skills. But I think their packaging, I think their marketing, I think the look of the band was cool. I liked what they were doing. I was well into my 70s by then when it first came out. So I'm like, hey, pretty good. But
Whippersnappers.
Yeah, and then then the second one came out, Shout at the Devil's Food came out. I was like, okay, it's pretty good. I kind of got into it, you know, when it first came out. And then I really, really started listening to it. And I'm like, there's some gems on here, some good metal gems, you know, 80s metal things. But to me, it hasn't held up at all.
Shout at the Devil hasn't.
Shout at the Devil hasn't really held up. It was definitely more polished than Too Fast for Love. But I like Too Fast for Love better because at least it was honest. It didn't cover up their horribleness, you know, the product with production tricks. And all. And again, there's a couple good songs on there, you know, worth going, yeah, to. And then, but I quickly, as I became a fan,
I became a non-fan. I saw a couple of their videos. I'm like, please stop it. Don't do this to me.
During the Shout at the Devil?
During that era. And I'm
so like
oh,
Looks a Kill video comes on and you're like, screw those guys.
Lame. I'm like, what are you doing? I mean, you're not that badass. And the whole, you know, the whole hot tub with the car. I don't even know what video that was. The hot tub with the limo in the back or whatever, you know.
That's like the uncensored video or
whatever
that is.
Yeah, I'm like, you guys are just, it's so contrived.
Hmm.
It's so contrived. But yeah, so that's kind of my history of Motley Crue. And of course, you know, then I was such a huge fan of Hanoi Rocks. And, you know, the rest goes without saying how that relationship ended with me and the boys in the crew.
The guys in Motley Crue went off the rails very quickly as soon as they had any success. So the Shout at the Devil tour is just a sordid history of drugs and debauchery, which we went into on the last episode. Some of the antics they were up to on the when they were on tour with Ozzy Osbourne are legendary. Of course, not quite sure exactly what to believe and how much of it is embellished, but they definitely were off the rails, and that all culminated in a car accident in December of 1984, where Vince Neil was going 65 into 25 with a 0.17 blood alcohol level. And crashed into another car. Well, supposedly he hits a wet patch of road. It had nothing to do with the 65 and a 25.
You know how much it rains in Southern California too, right?
Yeah. And you know, Razzle had severe head injuries, and the two people in the other car both had severe head injuries too. And Vince Neil had a concussion, but you know, I guess he had a thicker skull or something. But yeah, he's the one who walked away from the accident.
I saw a quote from him afterwards, because he did what, 18 days in jail? That's it? 18 days in jail before his trial, and then they let him off with, they let him off early for good behavior. You just killed a guy. What are you going to do? Act up in jail? You know, 5 years probation. And he says, quote, I wrote a $2.5 million check for vehicular manslaughter when Razzle died. I definitely deserve to go to prison. But I did 30 days in jail, but he didn't actually, and got laid and drank beer because that's the power of cash. Like, wow. Fuck you, dude.
Jesus.
Really?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And the whole, on the liner notes, the whole fake contrived, you know, hey, man, this album's dedicated to, you know, Razzle. It's like, come on, stop it, you know, And there's a little thing on there right before the lyrics on the lyric column. It says, to all crew fans. This is on the liner notes in the inner sleeve of the record. If you drink, if and when, see, they can't be contrite and just not still try to be, hey, man, we killed a guy, but we're really fucking cool, aren't we? You know, it's like, to all crew fans, if and or when you drink, don't take the wheel. Live and learn so we can all fucking rock our asses off for a long, long time to come. The crew, we love you. Like, such contrition. Come on, you guys. You know, if you're going to mention it, you know, fucking rock our asses off. And it's like, if and when you drink, you know, it's like, come on. It's like, we party. And it's just like, bring it down, dude. You just, the body's still warm, for Christ's sake.
Could that have been part of the $2.5 million settlement?
That's probably, yeah, you got to mention. That was probably part of his community services. Hey, man, you know, like, do a don't drink and drive campaign. All right, we'll put it on our lyric sheet. While we're talking about partying,
I remember as a kid going to in the lunchroom having fish sticks or whatever the hell they were serving in sixth grade or whatever, and some friends, we were all Motley Crue fans, and one of the kids had heard about Vince Neil was in a car accident, and there was a guy with him and he died and he's going to be in jail and we don't know if they're ever going to make another record again. And we were all so bummed. We're like, no, oh, that sucks. So we were all fans of Shout at the Devil.
Would have been so lucky, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know what's crazy is that was Vince Neil's second drunk driving charge too. So in this day and age, he would have been going to prison for a long time.
Well, he'd be in jail for life.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
For good.
Yeah.
But that's power of money.
Yeah, they sent him to rehab, and then they, you know, he ended up with that 30-day sentence, which he only served 18 days of. So that's insane that you have a 30-day sentence and you still get time off for good behavior.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, look, I couldn't even fuck up in 10 days in jail. Believe me, I've tried.
And yeah, I think I read something like $1.7 million went to the two people that got injured, and like $200,000 went to Razzle's family.
Sick.
So yeah, that's kind of crazy.
not even $1 million. Not even $1 million each for the other two parties.
And Vince Neil's wife was pregnant when that happened, too.
Oh, God. There's another one running around somewhere now?
That was his second kid. He had a kid when he was 17. And then he had another kid right after this, you know, right before Theater of Pain came out. So he was a very responsible guy, as you can...
What an ass.
Yeah, I mean, Vince Neil is a world-class fuck-up, that's for sure.
Yeah,
I was just listening to an interview, a great interview with Michael Monroe that Chris Shiflett did. I don't know if you guys have ever listened to his podcast, Walking the Floor. He's the rhythm guitar player, or maybe, I don't know if he's lead guitar. He's in the Foo Fighters, but okay. He was like a Sunset Strip guy. He was in a band called Brass Kittens with a Z or something way back when on the Sunset Strip. But he's a huge Hanoi Rocks fan. He did a great interview with Michael Monroe, and Michael was talking about how, you know, the Hanoi Rocks were from Finland, but they moved to London, and that's where they met Razzle. He was British, and he was a fan of the band. It kind of badgered them into letting him join. But yeah, they all loved him. You know, they really, Michael Monroe basically said it was just, he didn't feel right about ever doing Hanoi Rocks again without Razzle. You know, even though they were right on the verge of maybe big success, it was just over when Razzle died. That was
chemistry. There's a chemistry, yeah. And they had that captured. They captured that. They finally, you know, it's not when, you know, Two Steps from the Move definitely was not their first album. So they had worked and honed their sound, and they had built that. And once they arrived at that sound, it's like, okay, this is it. This is what's going to launch them. They get the Bob Ezrin thing, you know, and all of a sudden it's over, you know? So it's man, how are you going to find that again? Are you going to try to manufacture it and spend a lot of money, go into debt trying to recapture it? You know, because, you know, even though you get the big record deal, it's still just a loan is all it is. And a lot of people forget that.
Yeah.
So what do? You go, you know, you finally make your break. You're on your U.S. tour. Money's starting to roll in a little bit, at least, or at least you're starting to break even. And then you got to regroup. It's like, I know me, I'd just be like, fuck it. You know, so.
Yeah, they were in L.A. because they were here in America to make their play for the big time. It's like, that's why they were there. You know,
yeah, it was their shot. They had their shot, and it was their first U.S. tour, and they had money behind them.
Yeah.
They had backing. They had a great name producer, a record that was actually really starting to do well, and boom, dude.
Oh, that was it.
Cue Vince Neil.
Yeah.
Let's rage. He's still harboring a lot of rage.
Nah, from that. I like the guy. It's a wonder, though, he didn't eat the rest of the guys in the band. I mean, Mick Marsbar. Nikki Twix. And Sarah Lee, Jesus, he's got quite the appetite. That killer, Vince Neil.
See, he did show some restraint.
Right? Yeah. In fact, they're still walking around. It's pretty amazing to me. So.
Yes. So it's basically 2 months later that Motley Crue go into the studio to start working on their next album, and this is pre the 18 Days in Jail. He didn't do that until after or during their tour, I think, or something like that, in September. I think in September he went to jail, maybe even September 86. But he did the 30 days in rehab before they went into the studio.
Yeah, that worked like a charm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a story later of when they were on tour that Doc McGee put two of their security guys in the hotel room with Vince Neil and said, if he tries to drink, beat him up.
I like Doc McGee.
Yeah. But yeah, so they had the working title of the album was Entertainment or Death, which maybe was inappropriate given what had just happened.
Too soon.
But it's pretty funny that the Doug Thaler, who I don't know if he was one of their, were him and Doc McGee both their managers or something? He got Entertainment or Death tattooed on himself before they changed the name.
Oh, no.
God.
It's like tattooing your girlfriend's name on you. Just don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think both names came from the same thing, which was, well, there's all this, you know, Nikki Six probably tries to make himself seem a little bit more well-read and sophisticated than he actually is. But with his story about where he got the name, he was reading all these essays and, you know, about the court jesters, how they would, perform for the king. And then if he wasn't satisfied, they would be beheaded. So that's like the entertainment or death thing. But I think the, you know, the masks that are on the album cover and the Theater of Pain concept, I think come from that same, you know, those same stories. I don't know, but it is a cool album title and a cool album cover, I think.
Well, the cover is so ironic because you got the smiling Vince Neil who got away with murder, and then the sad fucking Razzle. I mean, it's just like the irony of that cover is just so overwhelming to me, because those are the two faces I see when I see those masks.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's,
yeah, I had never thought about that, but I guess if that's what you know, you suppose you could read that in there.
Oh,
but,
sure.
Wow.
You know, the comedy and the tragedy, if you will. And
well,
that's
true.
What they represent, you
true.
Know, in the classic sense. And obviously in this sense, to a T, really.
Yeah, it's back in 1985, I don't know. I think that was right. I don't know when like Mothers Against Drunk Driving started and stuff, but you know, there it became a very big, you know, movement in the culture, this anti-drunk driving thing. I'm not sure how prevalent that was yet at that point, but I did read that the actual date of the accident was the first day of National Drunk Driving Awareness Week.
Oh, sure. My God.
December 8th it was. December 8th.
Yeah.
It was Lennon's death day.
So it was you know, an issue. So that makes it seem even crazier that he got off, you know, basically scot-free practically for this. So,
yeah.
And yeah, that if you look at the album, yeah, there seems like a lot of insensitivity going on.
I think contrived, I would call it more contrived sensitivity, you know, false.
Yeah.
You know, they're putting the blurbs on there. It says on the inner sleeve, and buried dead center in tiny letters in the middle of the album credits column. What does it say? This album is dedicated to the fond and loving memories of Nicholas Razzle Dingley. And again, to the young and the young at heart, and to those who stuck with us through thick and thin. Like, come on. It makes it about them again. Just how about putting big letters at the top of the thing where people can actually freaking see it. Hey, Razzle, you know, sorry. Hey, Hanoi Rocks, we're sorry, man. Vince is a douche.
Yeah, it's like, our fans stick with us even when we murder and cripple people.
Exactly.
thick and thin,
almost,
you know?
Like, yeah. Wow. You know, so
it's better to not even say anything at all than put his name in there.
It's also backhanded and contrived. And,
yeah.
And it just, when I read that, I bought this album.
You actually have the vinyl and you've brought it over here.
I got it in that Columbia house, get, you know, 13 records for a penny.
Wow.
And then you move on.
It is in pristine condition.
It's never been played until this now, you know, and it's just, yeah, as I'm reading it, and I honestly sat down and listened to the whole thing with the liner notes, read everything, read all the lyrics, and sat with it like I would any other record that I really, really wanted to hear. And the longer that album sat in my hands, it burned. And I couldn't wait to put it down. I couldn't wait till the side two was over. It was just like, freaking.
So a glowing review.
Stay tuned for a great review. On my notes, the first thing I wrote is, this album is a slap in the face to anyone with ears. And then I wrote, this album is a slap in the face to anyone with a face.
Yeah, they sold 4 million copies of this piece.
Four million, AD.
I know, a lot of faces out there.
I bought one. So did you, AD?
Dude, I know. Well, I did.
Yes.
I did. I never paid for it. I never paid Columbia House their penny.
Okay.
So yeah, but I mean, like, dude, what's he wearing on the back? Is he actually wearing a woman's garter? It's a garter belt. He's wearing a garter belt. It's not like something like a garter belt. It's not something garter belt-ish. He's wearing a garter belt. Like, what are you doing, dude?
That was a little disconcerting for a 12-year-old Ryan when he got that record. Like, they looked a little too dolled up. The imagery of the dark Shout at the Devil band is gone.
Right.
And it's been replaced by a more glammed up Kiss Dynasty version of Motley Crue. And it was like, okay. And, you know, the mask cover, it's pink in the background. It's like there's a lot of pink going on. Where
yeah, there is.
That was not really there before. And it's like that's sort of the first clue that things have changed here in 1985 for you Motley Crue fans.
And you know, the whole band's wearing black. You know, I think the coolest thing about this record is Nikki Sixx's suit. That's badass.
The polka dot suit.
Yeah, I love that.
That is cool.
Yeah. I'd get me one of those. But, you know, the band's dressed in black. And, of course, Vince Neil is his outfit is mostly white, including the garter belt. And which is odd, though, considering all the greases and gravies that would be dripping on it later. I just find it odd. They, hey, you wear white. I'm going to get chocolate on it.
You know, and a meatball sandwich earlier. Yeah. Meatball fell out.
My favorite part of the back cover is that Mick Mars is somehow as tall as Tommy Lee.
right?
He's standing on like a milk crate down there. You can't see it, but.
Oh, yes, yeah, that's right. If you look at the bottom of the picture, they got Tommy from the knees up, and they got Mick Mars from like mid shin. That's true. Mars Bar. Sorry, Mick Mars Bar.
Yeah, they kind of did a cheap trick thing here with the how they've got the three guys in the black with the white background, and then they've got Vince in the light colors with the black background, and kind of, you know, the pretty boy. And then the weirdos.
He looks a lot like Barbara Streisand, though, in that picture, doesn't he? Like Babs's high school photo or something.
Yeah.
Like what?
Yeah, that is a little strange. I mean, talk about singling out your front man there. I mean, I don't think – is there an example of David Lee Roth doing that on a Van Halen record even? I mean, that is very strange.
Especially after what's gone down.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like why focus on that guy?
Yeah, put him in the background.
Right?
Put him on the back cover.
Put him in jail.
They pulled this record out of their ass, wiped their ass with the tape in the studio, and this is what they ended up with. And then they go out on tour. They're shooting heroin on stage, mainlining Jack Daniels, shooting up Jack Daniels instead of drinking it to come down off the cocaine, is what I read. So, you know, obviously after what happened with Razzle, they decided to, you know, get their act together.
Yeah, it just gets worse.
Yeah. Let's see. So the other two victims in the accident were Daniel Smithers, and they were young too, like 19 and 20 or something.
Breaking my heart.
Lisa Hogan, she was 18 and he was 20.
Oh, Jesus.
They got the Daniel Smithers got $700,000 and Lisa Hogan got $1.8 million. Okay. And then $200,000 to the estate of Razzle. Ooh, Vince had to do 40 to 50 hours of community service, but that included concerts that he performed that, you know, were for charity. So, man, they just let him literally get away with murder. It's crazy.
Literally.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a fan.
Well, right after this record is when Tommy marries Heather Locklear. A few other funny details. Nikki Sixx got a letter from his accountant explaining that he's spending $3,500 per day on drugs, and in 16 months he will be broke.
Yeah, I think I have a copy of the Heroin Diaries. I pulled it out for research, but I forgot that it doesn't start until Girls, 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 but he did mention something about that wedding, the Tommy wedding, and he had syringes in his boots. He was the best man at the wedding, and he had heroin-loaded syringes, and just the amount of money he was spending, not just that, but like, you know, he talks about, I'm flying back to L.A., and I called my buddy, and told him to have a full-loaded rig for me when I got there so I can shoot up in the limo, and I had the limo pick him up and pick me up at the airport so I can do a fix right when I walk through. It's just like, what is that costing you?
Yeah.
And just insane amount of money. And for what? It's like, it's ruining your life. It's like, God damn, you know? Yeah.
Well, a nice capper to the story is that, so Vince serves the 18 days in jail. And when he gets out, his AA sponsor picks him up and drives him home to his new mansion that he had only slept in one night before he went to jail. And when he gets there, it's all locked up. He has to break in to find out that his wife, Beth, who just had a baby, had left him and taken everything except his gold Rolex and his Camaro. But she did take the keys, is what it says.
Good. Good for her.
So, that's yeah. Good. So when he got home from jail, his wife was gone.
Good. Well deserved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he wasn't exactly, you know, faithful to her.
No. One thing said he was... going through five groupies a day on tour, but I don't know where that data came from. I don't know the source of that information. But yeah. Obviously, he was not. Yeah.
Well, he should have been, instead of going back to his mansion, he should have been going back to cell block 6.
Yeah, right. All right, so yeah, I guess unless you guys have anything else to say, we could go track by track on this thing.
Yeah, let's go.
I think we're ready, yeah. I mean, I haven't heard this record all the way through for probably about just 10 years. I remember getting it again in the advent of, you know, MP3s and whatnot. I'm like, oh my God, Theater Pain, I haven't heard that forever, so let's check it out. That's probably the last time I sat and listened to it front to back. So it was interesting to listen to it again all the way through and, you know, get back into 1985 again, the 12-year-old version of me, and going, oh, yeah, I used to like this one, but, you know, it just doesn't hold up anymore type of thing. But, yeah, it was just a interesting study.
Yeah, I never liked it. I mean, I talked about on the last episode about how I was kind of late to Motley Crue. Like, I was always a much bigger fan of all the other bands like Rat and Dokken and Def Leppard and Twisted Sister. I like all those bands 100 times more than Motley Crue anyways. But, you know, it took me a while to get into Shout at the Devil, which I do like a lot. But this record I never liked, you know, so I don't even have nostalgia for it, you know.
It's funny like how you listening to this record and just hearing the overall sound of the record, it's like, oh, yeah, so there was this one. There was Invasion of Your Privacy. And Fly on the Wall by AC/DC. So Rat, Invasion of Your Privacy, and Fly on the Wall were like the three tapes that I got that summer.
Tapes.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm pretty sure that's what I'm pretty sure it's those three. Because it's just so like, cool. Oh, God. And the funny thing is, to be honest, I don't like any of those records anymore.
You had MTV covered, though. That's pretty much all they played.
I think we had just gotten MTV at that point.
That's all they played.
Yeah.
I like Fly on the Wall, but Invasion of Your Privacy is definitely my least favorite Rat album of, you know, the early years. That was a big sophomore slump.
Well, they're coming off, all three of these records are coming off records that I do like. Shout at the Devil, Flick of the Switch, and Out of the Cellar.
Yeah, Out of the Cellar is amazing.
Those three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved those records and I still like them, but the three follow-ups were all sophomore slumps, man.
Yeah, I was thinking about how this record is like they were like kids that came to school and they didn't do their homework and they didn't study for the test. You know, that's what this album is. And then they're like cheating off their, you know, sitting across the aisle is Twisted Sister. And then in front of them is Rat. And they're like looking over their shoulders and cheating off their tests because they didn't do their homework.
I hear a lot
it's
of that.
Kind of what this album is.
Well, I'm going to bring up a few of those.
Like I said before, it seems to me they took Shout at the Devil track by track and said, okay, we need to, you know, Where's our, I don't even know any of the goddamn songs on that record. Shout at the Devil. Okay, we have a Shout at the Devil or their version of
Too Young to Fall in
Too
Love.
Too Young to Fall in Love.
Red Hot.
Yeah. So each song on this record is absolutely, they took it track by track and just rewrote the song, but worse.
I don't know about every song, but there are definitely cases where this is our double bass
up-tempo
number,
absolutely.
Like Red Hot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but how many of these songs took more than 5 minutes to write is my question.
Zero.
I say none.
Yeah, that's the problem is they just churn this shit out just to have something to release. And then the fact that they sold so many copies of it is just a travesty.
Oh,
So yeah, the album kicks off with City Boy Blues, which is one of the worst songs on the album.
I'm sorry, BJ. City Boy. I had Chips Ahoy Blues. I'm sorry. Okay, let me change that.
Yeah, take your note. Yeah, scratch that out of your notes. All right. City Boy Blues.
Okay, Chips Ahoy.
Yeah. Man, so, this song is awful, and Vince Neil sounds like complete shit. Vince is noticeably far worse on this album than on the previous records, for sure. And
agreed.
Yeah. And the chorus of this song is pathetic. Yeah, it really sounds like it was written in 5 minutes. And the fact that this kicks off the album, it just shows what you're in for with the rest of it. If this is what they thought should be the first song on the record, it's just like a weak facsimile of Motley Crue, kind of.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah,
it's funny that mirrors my very sarcastic opening statement on this particular number. I wrote a great little number to start this near perfect record off with.
Right, that's the bizarro version.
Yeah, probably my second or third favorite song on the album.
And that's opposite. That's the opposite of your actual opinion, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, this is in the bottom three of the songs, and you know that's quite an achievement to be one of the worst songs on this.
Now there is a pretty good Mick Mars bar throws in a pretty good slide solo. I gotta say, it's not a bad little solo.
I actually like the guitar riff of the opening. Actually, I like a lot of the guitar riffage here.
I mentioned that on my notes too. Mid tempo groove riff.
Yeah,
which
is weird for an opener, though.
But you know what, to me, though, was the kill. Just I burst into tears laughing. It's like right at the top of the show, and I made an audio clip of this, BJ. You may want to send it in, or I just did it on my phone. It might be, but it's almost like at the end of each verse, as he finishes the last line of each verse, it's almost like he's singing the lyric, and then Vince Neil looks up as his third dessert has arrived, and he just shrieks with delight. It's like, here, let me play it for you real quick. like if I'm talking like this, and all of a sudden I go, because my pie arrived. Here, listen to this.
His pie arrived.
He's like, he's done. As soon as I heard that,
this song to me, here's what my bone of contention with this song is. I think it has potential. I don't think the lyrics are that bad. I don't have a problem with the riff, but it's trying to be. This is one of the things where Motley Crue now is out of ideas, and they're just sort of picking from other sources. And this sounds like it really wants to be an Aerosmith song. And there is no sleazy Aerosmith groove to be had here. I don't know if it's Tommy Lee's problem, or they're just not locked in, or whose problem it is, but it just doesn't jive at all. Maybe Joey Kramer could have came in and played a better drum pattern.
No doubt about that.
But yeah, I think that's what's, for me, like listening to it last night, I'm like, if this was an Aerosmith song, it might work better if that's what you're into. Like, but it doesn't really work.
Yeah, this is their 10 Seconds to Love B-minus version.
Maybe.
Kind of the same vibe.
I just think it's a bad version of Aerosmith.
Just a bad version of everything.
And then I just wrote, Vince struggles on this one. Uh-oh.
I love the moment the pie arrives, though. For me, that's the song right there.
To me, it's just recording so uninspired. It's like they're not writing songs and making an album for any other reason except to just get an album out. You know, it's like, we just got to get this done so we have an album. And that's a really bad place to come from when you're being creative.
It seemed to me like it was never their design to be a band of musicians. It was just, to me, it was always designed and contrived to say, we want to be rock stars. And I never bought into them as musicians, ever. You know, just musically speaking, even from the beginning.
Hmm. Well, Mick Mars is just, you know, he came from a whole different school of music. He wasn't even in, he didn't even ever play this kind of music until Motley Crue. And so he's just kind of, you know, he's just playing a role here.
And he's the guy I think's got the most integrity in the band, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely. As a musician, well, yeah. People rave about Tommy Lee, but I don't really, you know, I don't know. Well, AD, you're a drummer, so you have a different perspective on it.
I just don't appreciate his playing at all.
There's something about his playing that I'm really starting to notice. Like last night, I was like, Tommy Lee is overrated.
Oh, he's horrible.
Some of the things he does is just not the right drum pattern for this riff, and a little bit too behind the beat. Maybe is that what do you pick up on?
Just a drunken bar band. That's the way they've always been to me. Just a drunken bar band who got lucky.
Yeah, I mean, he is solid. I like the way he hits.
He's
the
okay,
drums,
you know, he's, you know, okay, and he's got good production behind him. But the telltale is really Too Fast for Love when there's not mass. When everything's not masked in production, you can really hear what they're capable of. He's got a couple of double bass riffs, but it's all 16th notes, and who can't do that? I got 15-year-old students can do that, you know? So it's never been – he's never impressed me. It's all the stick twirling and tattoos and, hey, look, I'm in my underwear kind of thing. Fuck you.
Well, I think Nikki Sixx wrote great songs on the previous albums, but for this, he was obviously just way too fucked up and, you know, couldn't give a shit about – actually writing any songs.
Yeah.
Which is why the next song is a cover. This was a very smart cover song for them to do. I think it worked really well as a Motley Crue song, and it worked in 1985. It was kind of perfect. I never liked it.
I agree.
Are you talking about Choking Down Dessert Soon?
Choking Down Dessert Soon. Yeah.
This band should never do covers because their covers are terrible. Who would ever want to listen to this over the original? I can't even, you know, comprehend that. So, but it was a smart song to do, and it, you know, it obviously worked very well with a cool video and everything. It was, you know, perfectly timed, and it. The vibe of the song worked very well for them in this album. I never liked it, though. One interesting detail I found is that on tour, their security guy, Fred Saunders, would play the harmonica solo backstage while Vince would harp sync. Vince would pretend to play it on stage while the guy backstage actually played it.
Man, there's actually a great moment on this song. Actually, it's at 3:28.
It's a 3:27 song, AD.
Oh, I thought that was like, oh. I thought it was a dramatic pause in the. I counted them as geniuses at that point in time.
I agree with everything you said, BJ, about it. It's a great choice. Also, like, thinking back, the video obviously was huge, and everybody was excited to see it because we're all fans of the previous record, and it's like, okay, well, it's a little. Glammed up, but there they are. They got a new record coming out. Great. And then I remember hearing that this is a cover of Brownsville Station, and they always made mention of it. They never tried to pawn it off as something of their own and try to mask the fact that it was a obscure cover to the 12-year-olds out there in 85, you know, where obviously the Brownsville Station song and record it came from is tremendous, and everybody needs to own two or three Brownsville Station albums because they are awesome.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
But I think it's perfect, DJ. I mean, it's the perfect Motley Crue cover song, and it was the good choice for the first single. It's fun. It's good.
And Cub Coda and Michael Lutz were the writers of that from Brownsville Station. Cub Coda, who's rolling over in his grave, I'm sure. He died in 2000 from kidney disease. And Michael Lutz now, he was the bass player for Brownsville Station. And he's still alive and well. I did some research. Like, what are they doing now? Cub Coda's pushing up daisies. Michael Lutz, who produced Ted Nugent's Spirit of the Wild album,
really?
And toured with Nugent in the 90s, currently teaching guitar and bass at Oz's Music in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Wow.
So if you're in Arbor, Ann Arbor, stop by and see Michael Lutz.
Did he not get paid? Because he had to have made a mint on this song.
I'm
when
sure
Motley
he
Crue
did,
it.
Man. Yeah. Unless they see royalties out. But I don't
not.
Think they did. Brownsville Station were pretty good businessmen, from what I understand.
Well, and you know, this was a top 10 hit. I think it went to number 3, but that was in 1973, and so, of course, none of the kids that were in the Motley Crue had ever heard the song.
My buddy Six, Mick, and Tom, how many years was Mick held back to be in the same grade as... as Nicky and Tommy.
Yeah, he's like 13 years older than Vince or something.
I was held back in eighth grade for 13 years.
Yeah. Vince's mom. I don't think I like that Mick Mars boy.
Boy.
Why, he's 45. He shouldn't be playing with your G.I. Joes.
All right, so the next song on the album is Louder Than Hell, and
oh shit, I wrote Chowder Is Swell. I'm sorry.
This song wasn't good enough to be on Shout at the Devil when it was called Hotter Than Hell, so you know they recycled this one and it's complete shit.
Oh wow!
I wrote that it sounds like Vince Neil is chewing gum while he's singing this song.
Mushmouth, I know, man. What? Take the very first line.
Yeah.
Like, some like the violence. And like,
chewing on a donut while he's singing, for fuck's sake.
I mean, you almost think he's drunk, but he just got out of rehab, so he couldn't have been drunk.
of course not.
But yeah, I wrote that this song has like the proper components to be a song, but it just lacks any of the inspiration that would make it anything more than just paint by numbers. We need to put an album out. Let's get this shit recorded, whatever we have, you know?
Well, the pre-chorus is strong. I like that part. It's probably the strongest moment on the entire album. I like that pre-chorus. And Louder Than Hell is a little cheesy, but I mean, this is, to me, the standout track of
really?
The whole album. Yeah.
I probably my second or third favorite on the album.
Is it?
No, I've... That,
oh, you don't have one.
No. I called it a bad rewrite of Shout at the Devil's Food, is what I did.
It's a bad rewrite of Too Young to Fall in Love.
Okay, yeah, so bad rewrite, no matter what you call
Especially
it.
Especially the prequel.
This song, though, lyrically pays big respect to New England's favorite high-calorie belly warmer, Chowder.
Chowder.
But there's another moment in this song where Meal shrieks with delight when another full course dinner arrives at his vocal mic in the studio at the end of the chorus. It's like one of those nosebleed inducing moments, and it's right at the end of the chorus. I didn't do an audio clip of this, but maybe you could. Good God. It's just like
when he says something like it loud.
Then, ah! And it's just like she's like, ah,
oh,
a souffle. Yeah. Whoa. I mean,
it took forever to get these vocals recorded because of so many breaks.
Well, singing is hard work. I mean, you got to keep up the energy. And to keep that up, you got to have at least two entrees per verse and a choice of potatoes. So, I mean, you can't blame it. A guy can get hungry.
I think one problem with this album is there's a lot of separation between there's not a lot of guitar tracks. Vince's doesn't seem like his vocals are very layered, so you just hear his voice way too much. It should be buried and layered, and I think that's part of the problem on this is it's like you're hearing too much of his just actual attempt at singing instead of kind of disguising it and camouflaging it more.
Well, like you guys had mentioned before, though, he was mumbling and so mush-mouthy. Try doubling that.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. It's like, yeah, Tom Werman's already piecing it.
You sound like you're in a crowded room.
When you're piecing it together word by word, it's hard to double.
Right?
Yeah.
Vince,
I believe that half donut was on the left side of your mouth. Can you put that back in? We got more donuts.
And quit snapping those garters. It's picking up in the mic.
Yeah, what do they call that? Continuity on a film? Yeah, they have to. The placement of the cigarette and the, you know, chunk of food in his mouth when he's singing. You have to get it all back in the right place.
Pretty sure he had a mouthful of Jack Daniels at that point.
I think the Starburst was stuck on the left side, you know.
Oh. Let's move on to the next one because I fucking hate it.
it's the second worst song is what I wrote. Keep Your Eye on the Money. It's just laughable.
I'm sorry. I got all these titles wrong. I have Keep the Pie on My Tummy.
So keep the pie on my tummy. Pie in my fucking hand.
Yeah, it's easily my second or third favorite song on this amazing album.
Well, I wrote that this song is insulting to the listener's intelligence, basically. It's, well, I also wrote, if the car crash hadn't killed Razzle, hearing this song might have.
Oh! Wow.
Are you saying that maybe he heard the demo of this and died in the car before the accident?
Hey, Vince, I'm thinking we could take a ride around the block. What say you kill me?
Yeah, maybe Vince popped the tape in of this. Hey, you got to hear our new song we're working on. And Razzle Vince grabbed the wheel.
Wow. Oh, yikes. I see Vince in the studio with a set of headphones and a lazy boy lounger kicking back, his distended belly heading northward. And him just, there's only one pie left. He slumped down in that oversized chair, sweating pure gravy. And his arms are so bloated that he can't even point. So all he can do is grunt and nod his head, indicating that he'd like you to place that pie on his distended gut. I see that in the studio. Werman's going, all right, Vince, can we do another take?
Well, I wrote that this is a mess. The riffs are banal riffs. Local original band fair circa 1985. Like, you're thinking your worst local band in whatever town. And here's their new original. The most disturbing part of this song is that the whole ending bit is that disjointed and pointless ending that goes on for freaking ever. What in the... Tom Werman, where are you at?
I didn't even have any comment for that. I was just... I left that. I'm like...
It goes on for a minute and a half.
It does.
And the song's 4:40. It should be at 3 minutes.
The song should be at no minutes and no seconds.
I don't know what was going on. Tom Werman should have roped that one in. He'd maybe given up by then. Just like, oh, fuck it.
Can you imagine ones that didn't make the record?
Oh. Are there some bonus tracks? Or like B-sides?
Probably
I don't think
not.
So.
I don't think they left anything on the cutting room floor with this. Because they had to fill this.
Yeah. When you go on Spotify and listen to it, there's bonus tracks, but it's demos.
Yeah.
Of City Boy Blues, Home Sweet Home. Another take of Smoking in the Boys' Room. I don't think there's anything new, like unreleased.
No, I think anything they actually got to some point where they could call it finished, they put on the album.
Yeah, so they didn't leave anything on the cutting room floor. There's like, this is what we got, and that's
no,
that.
I think three of these songs are cutting room floor from Shout at the Devil, but...
Oh, Jesus, and a cover. Wow.
Yeah. But then we go in the Home Sweet Home, which is...
Oh.
This doesn't even seem like it's on the same album, because I was never... I never really loved this song or anything, but it is a well-written song. It has a great melody. I think Vince sounds a lot better on this song than the rest of the album, which Werman must have, like, said, this is actually good. We have to make sure we get something presentable out of this guy for this. I don't know. But yeah, the contrast in quality in terms of like songwriting between this and the rest of the album is, you know, pretty astronomical.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. It obviously, it's everything kind of works here. The verses are nice. The chorus. I mean, if you could stomach what this is, the It's sort of a defining power ballad. If you like this sort of thing, then it doesn't get much better than a song like Home Sweet Home. And Mick Mars' guitar solo is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's too bad that it gets cut in all the videos and the single versions of it. It was edited down. But yeah, I mean, and who among us didn't learn this on piano and play it on their, on every friend's mom's piano?
Me.
In 1986. Five.
Ham Sweet Ham. Probably my third or second favorite song on this amazing album. It's pretty self-explanatory, really, lyrically. Dude likes his pork with plenty of glaze. This was obviously their big MTV number, which really kind of redefined the band. Again, you mentioned the power ballad, and so it was a different sound, a different approach for them. But, you know, what band in that genre in that time didn't have to have that mandatory, you know, compulsory power ballad? But it really did redefine them. They went from a mediocre metal act with a slight degree of potential to a pathetic quartet of murderers, wife beaters, junkies, and Mick Mars.
Get on my plate, yeah. Ham, sweet ham.
I want some glaze. I want some glaze.
Ham, sweet ham. Okay.
It's just kind of like, where did this song come from, and how did they manage to put this together, considering the disaster that is the rest of the album? But well, one thing I read is that Nikki Sixx wrote some of these lyrics when he was 17, supposedly. So I don't know how long he had elements of this kicking around. But yeah, you know, this is actually a very well-written song. So
it is. It's a little reminiscent of On With The Show. From Too Fast for Love, like the chord sequence is very similar.
Yeah,
The verses maybe.
Again, with the remakes, you know, the redos.
But a better song than On With The Show,
certainly.
One could argue, although I don't want to hear Home Sweet Home ever again. I'd rather hear the other.
What this had going for it was a production again.
You could tell, like, it's definitely mixed. They spent time on this one. I would say they spent half of the time on this one song and the other half of the time on the other nine.
Maybe even more. Yeah.
They had to have this song had to happen for them or they were done, I think,
maybe.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
It brought the chicks in.
They were going for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had the smart cover and the ballad, and that's the only reason they sold any copies of this record.
Sure,
of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's formulaic. That's, you know, sign of the times back then, though.
Yeah.
Got it.
Get on my plate.
Yeah.
Get on my plate.
Yeah.
Ham, sweet ham.
I want some glaze. I want some glaze.
Ham, sweet ham. Okay.
So the next song, Tonight, parentheses, We Need a Lover.
Oh,
this is a reworking of a song, a Shout at the Devil era song called Black Widow. I like this more than the earlier songs because it's up tempo and has a hook on the chorus, but it's still just completely generic and would be the worst song on either of the previous albums. But I don't hate this as much as the other one, as like City Boy Blues.
I find this one to be the most frustrating because I think there's seeds of what could be a good song in
right.
here, but the lyrics and the hook, it just are slide down my knees and taste my sword. Fuck you. Come on. And the hook itself, Tonight, We Need a Lover Tonight. It's so Spinal Tap. It's Spinal
Tap.
It's just
totally generic. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, tonight we're going to rock you tonight.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. But, right.
Fuck that.
I hadn't even thought about that.
It's so stupid. It's just, and remember that pointless ending we were just talking about?
Yes, I did.
Let's do another one. Let's speed it up. God damn it, Motley Crue.
Well, I got the title wrong. I don't know. Yeah, I need to. It was dark in the studio when I was doing my homework. I wrote, I thought it was called Damn Right, I Need a Muffin. Easily my second or third album.
That was a stretch.
I had to work that one. But easily my second or third favorite song on this amazing record.
I see a pattern here.
It could have been Too Tight. I think my pants are too tight.
Too tight.
I need a muffin.
I need a muffin.
There you go. But I'm, I kind of panned the lyrics as well, Ryan. I went there. It's like it starts right off the bat. I mean, right off the top of 90,000 screaming watts, honey dripping from her pot.
Oh,
fill the cup to the top tonight. Yeah, of gravy. Deadly sin is all we know. Pleasure victim, who's next to fall? That would be Razzle. The question is, will you please us all?
Yeah, what's up with that? Like, we need one singular lover.
So it's like this chick. Yeah, you're gonna bang all of us, which is actually turned out to be Vince Neil's prison cell theme song, which is good. So you know he should be serving up rump roast at the cell block buffet any moment, as far as I'm concerned.
We need a muffin.
Damn right.
Point. Poor Mick Mars. He plays good guitar in this song. He's really digging in that the tone of his guitar, like palm-muting the shit out of it in that mercifully vocalless bridge and solo.
You know, Nick and Mickey should have taken the opportunity to just, at that point in time, instead of doing this record, just like, let's go find some two other dudes. Let's find a drummer and a singer and fuck this shit.
Yeah. I'm sure Elektra would have been all in favor of that. Sure, yeah, right.
Right.
They're like, get your asses in the studio, idiots.
You owe us money.
Well, it's funny. You know, 2 months before they were making this record, they were like, we don't have a singer. And then they're like, oh, wait, they're not even going to punish him. I guess we'll make a record.
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, one thing is said that they were all sitting around and they're like, maybe Michael can join our band. Maybe Tommy's going to join Hanoi Rocks. They were like, they don't know what the fuck they're going to do. And then they're like, oh, wait, they're not even going to send him to jail. Oh, okay.
Never mind. Let's get back to work.
Shit, I guess we need some songs. Wow. Man.
They never got him.
No, these were like, you know, lyrics that Nicky was writing in the studio as they were putting down the guitar tracks, and just hand Vince the paper as soon as you scribble it out, and then he, you know, spends 5 hours trying to piece it together.
What it sounds like, just like the next song, right?
Yeah,
here.
Use It or Lose It.
You should have thrown this one away.
Throw this one away.
I was really noticing the thin production on this album. Like, why aren't there more guitar tracks? Why isn't a song like this heavier? I don't know. I guess the Tom Werman, you know, he wanted to make it more radio-friendly kind of thing instead of more of a, you know, heavy, crunchy album at the time. I don't know.
The drums are taking up a lot of sonic space, the reverb on the drums specifically, and it sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I hit the same point about Tommy finally found his second kick drum there, sadly, because it just sounds like trash can falling down a fire escape. I mean, but it's funny because what BJ, what you were saying about, like, oh, they're trying to make it a single or like a radio thing or whatever. It's odd because there's that double bass, and who wants that on your radio, right? It was just so it's a misnomer. It's just like, here we're going to try to strip this down, clean it up. But it's, you know, drumming wise, the most ruckus number, at least starts out. There are moments in the song that are the most aggressive drumming wise. So it's just like, why doctor that one up? Find another tune that is more groove oriented to doctor up and make radio friendly, if you will.
Right.
You know? But Juice It, Abuse It. This song about Vince's disdain for those who juice their fruits and vegetables. Way too healthy. Way too healthy.
He doesn't care for that.
Yeah. And don't throw it away. He wants to eat. Are you going to eat that? You
know? Just the rinds that are left over.
You're wrapping up your meatball sandwich. Don't throw it away. You know? Yeah.
You're going to eat that.
Yeah. None. Touch my meal. Never mind.
Yeah, this just feels like a heavy metal song, so it needed, you know, heavier guitar. And, you know, I think this is another one that might have had potential to be something good if they spent more time writing it and, you know, recorded it differently or mixed it differently or something.
I don't find the guitar riff to be all that interesting. And no, since the
not
whole
really.
Song is built around it, that's just a recipe for disaster.
Right.
There's something that's too cheerful about it that it just doesn't work. Like, there's a major keyed quality to it that it's kind of there that maybe shouldn't be there, that we could kind of darken that up a little bit and make something better out of it.
I think that's the basis to the whole drum thing. That, you know, they if they would have built that around the drum, Werman probably knew they didn't have much. So it's like, well, all right, I got to do something. So I got to do something that is trademarky of Motley Crue, so let's just make this a Tommy song and put him in the forefront. And like you said, it took up all that room. He just, you know, pounding the crap out of those two bass drums, and it's just big and it's in the way. There was no room for anything else. But they seem like, it's almost like an admission, well, we got nothing, so just crank the drums.
Yeah, and then verses break down to that really dull halftime feel in the verse too. It's like there's so many things wrong here.
Yeah,
there's just not working for me.
No. But it's probably my second or third favorite song on this amazing record.
Yeah, it just came down to we need to finish 10 songs and just hope that Home Sweet Home sells this thing, because the rest of it is just, it's all filler. It's like they've got a cover, a ballad, and filler. That's it.
Cream filler?
Yeah.
So we press on.
What's the next song? Glazed egg rolls?
glazed egg rolls?
Glazed.
This is just plotting and uninteresting.
The chorus is so bad. It's so dumb. Yeah, it's this is another one that was recycled from an earlier song called Running Wild in the Night, which I remember that song. I think that's way better than this. I think they slowed it down. Yeah, I don't know what this is. This is supposed to be some kind of throwback to Shout at the Devil, I guess, but it's just so weak and dumb and formulaic and simple and just, you know, uninspired, basic. There's nothing, you know.
I feel like in the hands of Ronnie James Dio, this could be something.
Ronnie could take a song like this and elevate it, though, because he had that vocal prowess about him, and he could turn a phrase vocally.
Yeah.
So you could take the same lyric and similar melody.
Yeah, picture Dio singing the chorus as is, and you're like, oh, yeah, it's a cool little half, like, slow tempo Dio song.
Yeah. I mean, actually, and this, you know, this is probably my, I don't know, second or third favorite song on this amazing record. It's, but to me, it isn't so much a lyric as it is a room service order. Glazed egg rolls or 11, as the chorus begs the hotel's front desk.
Glazed egg rolls or 11.
Yeah.
So and room 11.
Yeah, yeah. No, 11 egg rolls.
Okay.
Or 11.
Maybe the room number.
But to me, it's like a bad ripoff of Terrence Trent D'Arby's great cut song called "If You All Get to Heaven," from his 1987 Introducing the Hardline album. Now, I know that this one came out first, but, you know, fuck it. They're going to rip somebody off. They're going to rip people off in the future, too. It's the way I look.
Oh, is that how that works?
Yeah, that's how that works.
Nicky used his Ouija board to steal the song from the future or something.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Because we talked on the last episode about how there were levitating forks and shit, supposedly. They delved into Satanism and forks were levitating in their apartment.
Into Vince's mouth.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. From his plate to his face.
Check this out.
Right into his razzle killing cock trap.
So for me, the next song is the worst song, and that's quite an achievement, but Raise Your Hands to Rock.
Good God.
It's so laughably bad. I wrote Razzle died for this.
Oh, wow.
The whole band should have gone to jail for this fucking song.
Oh,
yeah, this is a. They should have served the full 30 days for this shit. It's so bad, and Vince just is horrible on this. But yeah, you're exactly right. How would they ever double his vocal tracks? Just getting one usable, in quotes, vocal. It was hard enough, so...
Yeah, it goes from one guy mumbling to two guys mumbling at the same time.
That's not good. That's not adding anything. No. It's not helping.
Glaze your hams to rock.
Glaze is coming up a lot.
They use that sound a lot here.
Glaze your hams. This is, again, it's so poorly written and so poorly produced. When it starts, you go, oh, okay, acoustic guitar, it's a nice change of pace after Save Our Souls and Use It or Lose It. You're like, okay, so we're changing it up. And then I don't know what happens between the verse and the chorus, but it's like two different songs just patched together. And the chorus is like a mashup of I Wanna Rock by Twisted Sister and Feel Like Making Love by Bad Company.
That escaped me. That's good analogy. I wanna rock.
terrible.
Probably, though, still my probably second or third favorite song. It's amazing, right?
Or it's just like a parody of itself. It's just, it's so sad and pathetic and ridiculous that.
That's funny you said that, because that's one of the sort of general notes I made about this entire record and, you know, all that goes with it, including those clowns on the back of the cover, is I wrote derivative and I wrote caricature.
Yeah.
Caricature. And I think Ryan nailed it when he mentioned Spinal Tap. The whole record is, well, it's stupid, but it's not intended to be.
Yeah.
It's either just completely lazy or just completely distracted and drugged out, you know, wasted. So little effort and thought went into these songs.
I just think that as a whole, their well was not that deep to begin with. I don't think, you know, they did their best work in the first 2 years of their existence, and they didn't do anything after that. They just rested in on their whatever their laurels
and
they presumed to
there's
be.
There's an air of bravado around this entire record too, where it makes it even worse, because sure, there's no self-deprecating
right
lyric or anything that would speak to that.
There's no humility. You
know? Yeah. And that just makes it all play off way worse.
You know, and two, coming off the death of Razzle, you know, I kind of combed the lyrics. There's actually a lot of name checking going on in this record. They mentioned Martin Luther, James Dean, JFK, and Marilyn Monroe all in this record. And all of the above are dead, you know? So it's just like, Jesus Christ, man. I mean, is there no shame to them at all as they beat their, you know, bare bony chests and talk about how badass they are? It's just like, come on, you guys, man. A little humility goes a long way. You're not all that. You never were.
So we've made it to the end of the album. Fight for Your Rights. Another really original title and sentiment.
I got that one wrong too.
Oh, what did you have?
Fight in your tights.
What?
Are you trying to pull your pants on?
I don't know.
That's all I got. Hey, all right. Well, it was late.
You made it all 10 of them. You got all 10 of them.
But still, my second or third favorite song on this amazing record.
Side two is not going well. And this is the highlight of side two for me. This is the best song on side two.
Me too, because it's the last song on side two.
That's not necessarily the reason why, but I kind of like some of the guitar riffs and stuff in it. But the platitude of Fight for Your Rights is like, what? It's the albatross of this song. It's like, fight who and for what? It's like, what are you... It's just such a stupid 80s, the right to rock stuff that is so dated and so ridiculous.
Especially as he stole the rights of three decent human beings for their right to live a decent life. You know, it's like,
fight for your right to go 65 into 25.
Yeah, man. Yeah. There's just no humility. There's no self-awareness on this record whatsoever, man. None. Like, fuck, dude.
I mean, nice. I appreciate the, as I wrote in here, like, Martin Luther brought the truth, the color of our blood's the same, which is a nice sentiment. And sure, I'm sure he meant Martin Luther King and not the leader of the Protestant Reformation.
Right. Yeah.
Martin Luther, head of the Lutheran Church.
Right.
But,
because, you know, he had a plan.
He had, you know, a lot of the messaging of the song, I guess, is all right, you know, but the full Fight for Your Rights is a stupid, it's clumsy, it's like, nah. But the riffs are nice, and it's the best that side two has to offer on this album, or on the, you know, on the side.
Again, I think the Band of Silence near the end of the record, right before the needle lifts up, is
the run out.
Brilliant. But also, yeah, you mentioned lyrics too, and I think there's a song that. Lyric in this song that goes completely unanswered, but I'm going to answer that for you. It has baffled a lot of hardcore Crew fans for years. It comes at the very end of the first verse's second stanza. The lyric reads, "Not taking sides, just asking why. Does the pain eat the children? No. Vincent Neil eats the children." Have you seen him lately? Jesus Christ. Look at that fucker. He's still got crumbs all over his face. Children, baby crumbs.
Jesus. So what do you think about this one, BG? We kind of stepped on.
It's probably in the upper half of the songs, but that doesn't really say much for it. It's not any good. It's like, I wrote, it's like an impersonation of a song. It's a band trying to sound like Motley Crue, but, you know, not doing that great a job of it, is what it seems like to me. It's not horrible, but it would still be, I wrote, if it's not the worst song on Shout at the Devil, maybe it's better than 10 Seconds to Love. And then, so this whole, it's like if you had the whole album is as good as or worse than 10 Seconds to Love, you know, that's what this record is. It's, most of the songs are, just have nothing to offer or very little, you know.
It's very pedestrian.
Not even a free dessert.
Vince ate it.
Yeah,
but I think it's obvious what happened. They went into the studio with very little prepared and just pulled this out of their ass.
Definitely.
So
this was the album that was the last Motley Crue album I ever bought. I can tell you that. I went, after a few months of listening to it when I was 12, I was like, I don't like this. It reminds me of Animalize, While the City Sleeps and Lonely is the Hunter. You know, those kind of songs on that album, which are just boring and just lay there lifeless. And that was it. You know, I was done with Motley Crue and never went back.
Yeah, I truly, honestly, I give the album like a 1 out of 10.
1 out of 10.
Yeah, it was horrible then. It's worse now. It just is. And real quick, I got a follow up to Vince's shenanigans. This was what, 1985? So in 2002, Vince Neil was arrested for punching Michael Schumann, a producer, to the ground in a nightclub parking lot. He paid a fine and did community service. Now, this is after killing somebody and maiming three people for life on his second DUI. And he still just pays a fine, doesn't go to jail. 2003, 1 year later, he assaulted a sex worker at the Moonlight Bunny Ranch by grabbing her by the throat and throwing her against a wall. 30 days suspended sentence, anger management classes, and an $1,132 fine. So there's that. Then 2004, we're on a roll. Assault on a sound man after a show. Sound man was left unconscious for 45 minutes while he got off with a warning for criminal trespass. What? 2007, arrested again, third DUI in Las Vegas. Pled a deal down to reckless driving. 2010, another DUI in Las Vegas. He fled drunk after smashing a fan's camera. 15 days in jail, finally. 15 days house arrest. And then in 2011, he was charged with battery and disorderly conduct when he beat his ex-girlfriend. And his punishment? He was told to stay away from her.
Wow.
Two words, fuck you, Vince Neil.
And then the first page I opened,
scumbag man,
in the Heroin Diaries, I just opened up to it and checked, tried to find the dates surrounding this album we're talking about today. But there was an anecdote in there where some guy was talking about having dinner with Nikki Sixx or being at the bar, the Rainbow, you know, in Hollywood or something. And over the next table is Vince Neil, and they're arguing. Vince and his girlfriend are arguing, and then he just hauls off and hits her right in the face with his fist. And I said to Nikki, I said, should we intervene here? And Nikki's like, nah, let them sort it out.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. What the fuck, you guys?
Zero respect for this ass. He's a joke. He's a menace and he's a punk. There.
Yeah. Yeah, can you imagine getting away with two more DUIs after you killed somebody?
Right.
Yeah.
You and I couldn't get away with that.
No.
Yeah, and when you have a guy like Vince Neil, when he just keeps getting away with everything, it just feeds into, just makes him worse, you would think.
He has, to me, zero redeeming quality. None. Not a one. Except the garter belt. I love that. That's entertainment. Pure entertainment. I'm laughing at you, Vince Neil. Laughing at you. Not with you. At you, you fuck.
Wow, okay. Tell us how you really feel.
Nah. Guy's a scumbag.
So why were Motley Crue so popular at this time? I mean, I think a huge role was the visuals, you know, the era of MTV, and they had the great visuals. They had the videos. So that was a big part of selling these albums. had very little to do with the music, I think. It was the era of PMRC and all of that. So Motley Crue were actually considered like dangerous or whatever. They had all this kind of stuff going for them.
Yeah. Yeah. They certainly played up that danger and that party, that rock and roll party atmosphere and all that stuff all the way through the 80s, you know. And it was the visuals, and it was the fact that they brought in a lot of female fans as well. So it wasn't like Wasp, you know, where it started. They looked like Wasp at the beginning, but then they made that shift into the lighter kind of glammed up pink colors and stuff like that, where, you know, now you get half the audience or more than half the audience is female. And so that is quite the war chest of money to keep that whole ball rolling. And they sold a ton of records and they had all this money. They couldn't spend it fast enough, apparently.
Plus it was the times. It was the 80s and it was the time of bigger, louder, more, you know, power, everything bigger, brighter, faster. And if you could, you know, draw a picture, like if there was a band called Rock and Roll Excess, you know, the caricature would be these guys on the back of the album cover. I wouldn't say characters, caricature, because you know what I mean? So they're taking that idea of rock and roll excess and just trying to live it, becoming cartoon characters, playing a role almost, you know. They as people were caught up in it, but the record label never stopped them and just went, yeah, you know, it's the mid 80s. That's people are doing tons of cocaine and driving fast cars and the money's good. Times are good. It's a great decade to be alive and spending money and all that. But they just, you know, I wish somebody else would have been given that sort of banner to carry rather than these ass clowns. You know,
more like Hanoi Rocks.
Yes,
perhaps.
exactly. Some band who actually deserved it and had a redeeming quality, had some skill, you know, could play their instruments and could write songs.
Well, Motley Crue could write some good songs early on, but as we've discussed, they lost that ability.
But Amazing Grace is a great song. You give that to Vince Neil. I mean, the Star Spangled Banner. Look what he did to that, for fuck's sake. You ever heard him do that?
I don't remember.
Oh, Vince Neil singing the Star Spangled Banner? Google that.
Here we go!
Like here's this rock and roll, rather than you know, the record label's propping them up, spending all the money on them rather than any other band in their stable. So the record label is at fault as anyone else. I suppose they had to get their money back, but what a shame, what a wasteful investment in millions of dollars in this train wreck of a freaking band.
Well, they made some money.
Like, again, and no, you know, no, I still say props to Mick and Nikki. I like them. But man, the other two. Fuck.
Yeah, I like Mick Mars, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And Nikki has some good qualities.
I like it. Well, see, Nikki came out of his drug haze with humility. He wrote the book and said, I was a total fucking ass. Yeah. I was a shithead and I was a mess. And he came out of that with humility. And I will always respect him for that.
Are you talking about the Heroin Diaries?
Yeah. With his words, and he describes all those times. And he, after the fact, says, I'm an ass and I've straightened my life out.
Yeah.
What about what's Vince doing as we speak? He's got a turkey leg in one hand, a fucking, you know, jumbo fucking mimosa in the other at the fucking waffle bar in some casino, fucking syrup dripping down his fucking face. Going, yeah, I should probably get another record soon. He hadn't learned a thing, you know?
Definitely. Nikki Sixx had a lot of songwriting talent, but very little of it is on display on this album.
Well, you did it, AD. You got through it.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for actually listening to this album. I know it was a lot to ask.
I hope it wasn't too dark. I mean, it was pretty scathing from all of us at least one point or another.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this record doesn't deserve very much praise.
Somebody was telling me that they wanted to come see our concert once, and their parents wouldn't let them because they said we kill chickens on stage. It's like, what? Chickens?
be back.